we're out in this village, and we had our dinner, and it consisted of sticky rice and lao lao, and some kind of this stew with this meat in it. And the meat was very tasty. And so that night, my interpreter and I were laying there in bed, or in our sleeping bags, and dinner. And I said, "Fine." He said, "Did you like the meat?" And at that point, something crossed my mind. You know, I didn't see any chickens running around in this village. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any pigs running around. Those are the two staples, chickens and pigs. You know, a few ducks, but mainly chickens or pigs. And I said, "What was it?" He said, "It was rat. The rats over there were not like your rats around here. They were large rats." Mm-hmm. And fed on a lot of grain, a lot of, you know, different things, and they were big. You know, they were the size of a cat. Mm-hmm. And in areas where they were a delicacy. And so they had this rat in a stew, and I mean, there were no bones. It had been taken off the bones, and it was just good pieces of meat. So I can say I've eaten rat. I have also eaten grasshopper. Mm-hmm. I was in this other village, and when you're a round eye, as they call them over there, American, a lot of times you're the guest of honor if you go into some village. Well, I went into this one village, and there was this old lady, and she had this basket full of fairly large katydid-type grasshoppers, mm-hmm. you know, long, long wings. And she was skewering them on this little bamboo stick. And I, you know, looked at it, didn't think much of it. Well, then I see her, once she got a couple dozen on there, she passed them over the flame and burned off the wings and burned off the legs, and then she pushed them back off onto this little plate. When it came time to dinner, mm-hmm. I was the honored guest, so I got the first choice of barbecued grasshopper, barbecued katydid. So I picked one that looked probably the most crispy, and it wasn't bad. It was like a potato chip. Mm-hmm. But some people would probably be pretty squeamish, but being an entomologist, no big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
So
study them, see them.
Yeah, eat them.
Eat them.
And then one other one I'll tell you, then we'll get on to something else. Mm-hmm. But when we'd go out to these villages, we'd also, a lot of times, supplement, you know, stuff that we'd take along to mm-hmm. eat, that we would either open up for the evening meal and share it with the people, or if we'd just be out on a little day trip, I used to take, you know, cans of sardines, because mm-hmm. they were handy, compact, and, you know, I liked them. So we're out in this village one time, and the further village is out, the more weird things happen. If you're close into the center, you're close, you know, where they have quite a bit of contact with Americans, that's one thing. But if you're out, you know, an hour's flight somewhere, you get some people that haven't seen too many conveniences of the modern world. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting with my interpreter, and we're having lunch, and there we're eating sticky rice, and I get in my backpack and pull out this little can of sardines. Pop the lid off and start pulling them out and eating them. People start gathering around looking. They start talking back and forth, and pretty soon the interpreter starts laughing. I said, what are you laughing about? What are they laughing about? He said, "They want to know how you get all those fish in that little tiny can." I said, "Well, it comes that way." But interesting foods. And I still enjoy sticky rice to this day. You steam it. You don't boil it. You steam it up.
Yeah, my wife loves it.
Yeah, and I love it. And in fact, we tried to find some today, and we got some, but I don't think it's a true sticky rice. But the package says you got to soak it 12 hours or overnight. Well, this stuff that I'm used to, mm-hmm. you can soak it for an hour or so and steam it. It's fine. So I may have to look around some more. But anyway, interesting foods. Also, we were traveling, I think, when we were in orientation for our language. And we were traveling from the capital out to Paksan, which is 70, 80 miles. We stopped at this little roadside stand. This was early on in our training. Mm-hmm. And there was this big round pot boiling over this fire, and with a ladle sticking in it. And so somebody went up, I was up there with them, and they kind of just started stirring it to see what was in it. And pretty soon this chicken claw and this leg comes up around like that. When they cut up a chicken, they take a cleaver and they just chop it in, and there's no piece recognizable. Mm-hmm. Except the claws and the neck and the head and all that stuff. And of course, the head's a delicacy over there. But here was this claw coming up, and I kind of looked at it. Well, I think I'll pass on that. But there again, culture. Mm-hmm. It's good. But other than traveling around to a lot of the different villages and And those, most of those were where they had, we had different rice plots out, both hillside and small valley, little valley where they had paddy rice. And during the growing season, I'd go out and check to see how it was doing, and we, and talk to the people some, but if it get a little more technical, that's why I had the interpreter. Mm-hmm. And we just see how their rice was growing, and if they had any concerns, or sometimes you'd go out and there'd be insects chewing on it, so we'd have to arrange to get some little backpack sprayers and come out there and spray a little plot. Since a lot of this was experimental, we'd spray part of it with certain materials. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we used any DDT. I don't know what we did use, but it was some kind of, you know, insecticide that was okay to use on rice. We'd spray part of it, and then we'd leave the other part. Of course, the part we didn't spray, it'd get all chewed up, and then it would show again how wonderful insecticide is, if you can get it. but it was a very, very interesting 2 years. Some of the flights were a little hairy. There was this one flight. A lot of times when you're a rookie over there, and these USAID folks that have, most of them have been former IBSers, mm-hmm. that went on to USAID, that have flown all over the North Country. We were going up to one site, and there was a guy named Terry Collins that used to be IBS, but then he went to USAID. Mm-hmm. And there was this one, the site we were going to is one that the airstrip is quite small and it's built right on top of a ridge. Mm-hmm. There's drop-offs on each side. And the wind can get very strong coming up these canyons. Mm-hmm. There was only one type of plane that could land there because that would have enough power to get off of that strip. Mm-hmm. And it was one of these Porter aircraft that's, mm-hmm. I think, made in Switzerland. And
Plattis Porter.
Yeah, that guy. Mm-hmm. Mostly engine. A little bit of fuselage behind it. So we were going into this. Terry was going up there, and he says, "You want to ride along?" I said, "Sure." He said, "You sit in the front." So they set me in front. We fly up there. We start coming around, and here's this little tiny strip sitting up on top of this ridge. I mean, it looked like a Band-Aid up there. Mm-hmm. So we come down and start circling around. And so Terry was in the back, being very quiet, you know, just chuckling to himself. So the pilot said, don't be alarmed if we don't land the first time. Because he said, if I don't hit right on the end of the runway, then he said, we're going to have to go by. Because he said, it's going to take all the runway. And he said, if the wind gust catches me just as I'm coming over that last canyon, mm-hmm. then I'm going to have to abort. Because he said, it's got to be still so I can hit right on the end. Came by the first time, coming on in, wind hit us, went around again. Second time, same thing happened. Third time, I'm getting a little antsy because that strip's looking smaller and smaller. Third time, we hit right on the end, and as soon as the wheels touched down, he reversed the pitch of the prop and dropped the flaps, and we taxied right up to the end and stopped and turned around and went back to the village and, you know, did our business or whatever. And then taking off was the fun part because you just go back to the end of the runway, turn it around, and go as fast as you can, and just shoot off the edge. Mm-hmm. And you shoot off the edge, you drop and catch it and go. Mm-hmm. But the landing was fun. And there were a number of sites that were like that. Mm-hmm. That this was the only one that had to have that certain aircraft. But you hear all kinds of war stories. There was one flight that they brought called a Caribou aircraft. It had a number, 207 was the variety or model number.
But it's a twin engine transport.
Yeah, twin engine, but it's a couple models down from the C-130. Mm-hmm. They use those a lot, call them Caribou. And it had flown into this one site that had mistaken for another site that was much larger. And it had landed at this small strip that mm-hmm. was not big enough for a Caribou. Mm-hmm. Well, once they were on the ground, they realized it. So what they had to do was they totally gutted out as much of the interior of that plane, took out seats and, of course, all the cargo and everything. Mm-hmm. They actually had to clear some more land to make it a little bit longer runway. And then they, when they decided to be ready to fly it out, they took it clear back into the brush as far as they could and went wide open. And as soon as they lifted off, they collapsed the landing gear and they got it out. But it was
close.
Very tricky.
Yes, I've started out in the jungle.
Yeah.
And flown out on a small plane.
No.
Yes. You know, when I was interviewing Brenda, you know, I asked her, what was Gary doing? She says, well, he'll tell you about that. But you were gone an extensive period of time out of San Antonio. I mean, you were out all the time.
I was out probably on the average of maybe a couple times a week. Mm-hmm.
What did you do when you were not out? You were going over to Longshan and working in the
experiment station? I would be over there or during the growing season when we had the paddy rice, mm-hmm. and when we see that we had, we're talking about 2 different years. So one year mm-hmm. we had, I think the first year we had more rice production. Mm-hmm. Second year we had the kind of a variety. But mm-hmm. when we were doing the rice production, we had 4 or 5 or 6 different areas. And so those, and then I would also stay at the farm in Longchang. They had mm-hmm. they had showers, and it was, you know, it was a rock and concrete building and quite nice mm-hmm. that the Americans had built mm-hmm. or guests or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I would stay over there a certain part of the time, mm-hmm. and then I would be out in these different villages, and it was...
One of the things that came up with Brenda was that, you know, she was working in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You were flying out or transporting to areas where you were doing agricultural support mm-hmm. and experimental stations, and that's what you were doing. That was your job,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you did.
Mm-hmm.
You were told going out there that there were some things up there that were supposed to be left up there.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't help seeing some of those things, but you developed an attitude about those things that was healthy, I think. I mean, for you.
Mm-hmm.
But that when you saw other IVSers, they would always ask you questions
right.
and assume also that you knew a whole lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with that? What was your take on that?
Well, you had to really dummy up, because you knew if you would say something to them,
mm-hmm.
it would get back to Pop Buell, because
mm-hmm.
he knew everything.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing that got by him.
Mm-hmm.
He had people everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
He had all kinds of people in Vientiane. He had people in the field. If little Gary IVSer would say something that he shouldn't have said,
mm-hmm.
Pop would know about it within the hour.
And what would happen then?
My tail would be in a sling, and I'd be back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
I would be back to IVS Vientiane, and probably I would be out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he made it very clear very soon. What goes on up here stays up here. You're going to see things up here that you're not going to realize what's going on. It stays up here.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever see anything that had any significance that you could understand or even
just
comprehend
the,
in terms of what was going on?
Just the amount of mm-hmm. military hardware that was coming in along chain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were C-130s coming in numerous flights a day.
Mm-hmm.
And they would not shut those engines down. They would land, the stuff would come out on a
pallet.
It'd be on pallets.
Mm-hmm.
It'd come out. They wouldn't be on the ground more than 30 seconds till they'd turn around, they'd be in the air, and an hour later they'd be back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, tremendous amounts of military hardware, ammunition, all kinds of, I don't even know what stuff.
Were you aware that, did the secret war in Laos mean anything to you? And I say this because when I read the Pentagon Papers as a kid,
mm-hmm.
I just assumed that everybody knew all of that. It just, I wasn't really conscious of.
Well, we very soon knew that there was a lot going on up there mm-hmm. that they weren't aware of in the States.
Uh-huh.
And even in, see, we would get the, Stars and Stripes
mm-hmm.
Magazine or newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be things in there from Laos that you know, you'd hear about or you knew that something would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the Stars and Stripes, it'd be doctored up.
Mm-hmm.
My parents sent articles from the States about something that went on in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time it got to the States, it was totally blown out of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there'd be a plane crash and a couple of people would get killed, and in time they get back to the States and we see the article, there'd be a half a dozen people killed, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just, it was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, talking about things that we would see, and then, see, we went down to Vientiane quite often.
Mm-hmm.
It was, what was it, half hour, 40 minute flight.
Mm-hmm.
And these planes flew every day, unless the weather was bad, but they mm-hmm. flew every day from Vientiane to Sam Tong.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very easy to hop on a plane, fly down to Vientiane,
mm-hmm.
go to the commissary, buy groceries, and fly back up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same afternoon, just like a milk run or something.
Mm-hmm.
Days it was clouded in, they couldn't fly, it got real quiet up there because there were no planes.
Mm-hmm.
But we had it pretty good as far as, you know, an IVS or out in the field.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in Laos especially.
Oh, yeah.
The ones that were doing community development
mm-hmm.
upriver, so to speak. They were in a
yeah.
whole different world.
And there was a lot of envy.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people in Vientiane, I'm sure you know Ron Pulcini, or
mm-hmm.
you've heard of Ron
yeah,
Pulcini.
I haven't re-interviewed him.
Okay. Ron and June, he was they were with IVS, Vietnam, I think.
Cambodia and Vietnam.
Cambodia and right. Vietnam, right. And then he went to work for USIS mm-hmm. in Vientiane. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was his job to get information. Mm-hmm. And we would fly down to see him, and boy, he would try to get information out of us. And I mean, he knew that we knew, mm-hmm. but he couldn't get it out of us.
Well, other than the size of the military resupply, mm-hmm. other than that, what did you know? Now that you can tell anybody that you want, because it's a...
Is this all out now?
Yeah, it's all out now. There are no secret... Well, but of course, the real joke was the only secret about any of these secret wars, like in the bombing in Cambodia, was it was secret in the United States. Mm. So there wasn't much of a secret
there.
Right there. Yeah, but what did you know?
We knew there was a whole lot of U.S. involvement going on up there mm-hmm. that was supposed to be secret. Mm-hmm. I mean, we worked with military attachés mm-hmm. in Sam Tong mm-hmm. that weren't there. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how much Brenda got into the military doctors mm-hmm. that she worked with. Mm-hmm. There was a doctor that was assigned to the hospital mm-hmm. to work with the Lao doctor, mm-hmm. An American, I think it was there for 6 months at a time or something. Mm-hmm. Doctor would come in mm-hmm. and because probably I don't know what percentage, but a good percentage of the people that Brenda worked with at the hospital mm-hmm. were military casualties, right. Mostly Laotian, mm-hmm. Mayo, different tribal people, but there were occasionally Americans that would get messed up and mm-hmm. they would stop there before they went on down right. to Vientiane or to Bangkok mm-hmm. and so the military doctor that was there, and then the military attaché. We had military people going through all the time that mm-hmm. they weren't there, but
was essentially privileged information about the degree of American involvement essentially a civil war going on in Laos, mm-hmm. but also played out along the Ho Chi Minh Trail with the North Vietnamese,
right. and all the stories about things going on and what is it, Pupati, the mountain up north that where they had a radar site way, uh-huh. way up north. Uh-huh. And I have not read the account. I'm sure, I know it's out in a book somewhere.
It's in Roger Warner, in Backfire.
Is it in there? Okay.
It's in Backfire.
Yeah. About the ones that were up there and it got overrun and right. they were killed. And mm-hmm. and at one point the story was before this, in afterthought, well, why don't they go up there with planes and just napalm that whole area mm-hmm. below the hill where they yes. were climbing up? Mm-hmm. Well, that's too cruel, What's war, You either win it or you don't. But to let these guys go ahead and get up there, overrun the place and kill the Americans, come on, folks. What are we doing? Are we fighting? Are we, it's just...
Yeah, but that doesn't sound right. The use of napalm to protect a secure... It's essentially the radar beacon for the assault on Hanoi.
Right.
I don't think they would have hesitated to use napalm.
Well, you see...
But that's a story.
Float around. The story...
Could be.
We heard that these guys climbed up there at night
and
assaulted the place and killed the Americans. Mm-hmm. And the thought was, how could you have prevented that? Well, one of the things was, bomb them down below before they get a chance to get up there, but... And then also the word was, that's too cruel. That's can't do that. Well, they killed the Americans. Mm-hmm. But and just different stories. The day I flew out of Laos, or the day that I flew out of Sam Tong. I don't know if Brenda told you about the last 6 months that we were over there. She was.
No, go ahead.
Well, the last 6 months. This would have been in the heights of the dry season in '69. Mm-hmm. Bad guys were getting pretty close. Mm-hmm. They were like 2 kilometers away, mm-hmm. but there were 2 mountain ranges in those 2 kilometers. Mm-hmm. And so they felt that it was not safe for the women to be up there, mm-hmm. the Americans. Mm-hmm. And so Brenda and I think Ann Bradley, I don't know if Ann Bradley was still there, but Brenda and several of the other women mm-hmm. worked the last 6 months down in the Filipino hospital in Vientiane. Mm-hmm. And I would fly down on the weekends and stay down there. And so the military attaché brought this pistol over one night mm-hmm. and told me that I was to keep this and keep it with me at all time mm-hmm. and sleep with it in a boat. And he said, if we get overrun, he said, start shooting. I had never handled a pistol in my life. Mm-hmm. I knew which end the bullet came out of, but that mm-hmm. was about all. Mm-hmm. And this was a big one. This was a big, I don't know what it was, but it was a big pistol. Mm-hmm. And from the time we went up there, right at first, we always had a little, what we called a bug out bag, which was our little bag of, you know, cans of sardines and different things that if we would get overrun, we'd grab that and take off. And it was so weird because in this bug out bag, this is crazy. I had taken this Beatle book over there that was the Beatles of the United States, but it also covered different things. But I had taken it over there to just to keep track of the different families of Beatles that I was collecting. That was almost like a Bible to me. I mean, I have the signatures of people that wrote sections of it. I have the author's signature. I mean, that's really important to me. I kept that in my bug out bag. I would throw out a can of sardines to have that book in there because that was not going to get lost. But it was kind of uneasy situation sleeping with that pistol under my pillow because there were stories about, you know, guys come in and you literally grab what you can and run for your life and keep your head down. And so the last 6 months were a little shaky, but the day I flew out of Sam Tong for the last time would have been in probably early September of 69. That afternoon, there was a pilot that I knew pretty well that had come into Sam Tong, or to Longchang. A lot of these pilots would overnight at Sam Tong. They had a little bed and breakfast type thing and had probably half a dozen or so rooms, and it was Air America Chalet. It was run by, you know, Air America. And at any one time in the busy season, there'd be a dozen or so pilots that would stay there with their planes. And just, they slept up country in Sam Tong.
Thank you.
And so they would fly directly into Sam Tong, or they would fly into Longchang and then pick up refugees or relatives or whatever of people that they knew to be in the Sam Tong area. And so they would stop off and pick up these folks and fly up over the hill to Sam Tong and overnight. Well, this pilot had stopped in. I think he had a Helio Courier, which are a little smaller plane, but still a short takeoff and landing. But he had picked up, he had stopped and dropped off whatever he had to drop off, picked up half a dozen or so people, which was way overloaded, in that little plane. Knew he was low on fuel, but figured he had enough to get up over the hill to Sam Tong. Got almost to the top of the ridge, ran out of grass, splatted into the side, everybody was killed. And when I flew out, I can still remember looking back, I was in a can up over the ridge and heading on down and looking back and seeing that plane against the hillside, and it was still smoking. And knowing that this pilot and half a dozen or eight people had died right there. I can still see that picture as I'm leaving, looking back at that plane. And got down to Vientiane. By then the word was already out that, oh, do you know that, I forget what the guy's name was. I mean, the word was coming in before we took off from Sam Tong that this guy had crashed. But they didn't know how bad it was. And then the word came in that he had been killed and all the others, and that he just flat ran out of gas. And there were other ones. There was one of the, there was a guy that flew up country. He was a pilot. And 3 days in a row, he took a hit in his plane about a foot behind where he was sitting. And what happened, you get some of these folks up north that you know, they'd see a plane come over the hill or something, they'd shoot right at it. Well, right. By the time the bullet would get there, he'd be back behind it. And 3 different days, he took a shot within a foot of the same area on that plane. And he said, I'm not going to fly up there again, because if somebody tells that guy how to lead a plane, then I'm in trouble.
Yes. There are a lot of stories about that, by the way. About
some incredible
sniper
stories.
At the end of, I think, a runway in Da Nang, who would always miss. And after a while, it's one of those things that happen in wartime. They began realizing he missed on purpose. Well, he was like chained to a tree out at the end of the run. So they had this deal where, you know, if they killed him, he'd be replaced by somebody who might be fanatical and might sacrifice his life to shoot down an American plane taking off the runway. So instead, they never sent a patrol out at the end of the runway, and he never hit an American aircraft. And there are several stories, famous stories, one on the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Interesting.
About an aircraft battery on a karst that always missed the planes as they came by, and they got the idea, and the pilot started protecting that battery.
Just,
you know,
so
you're waving other aircraft off and leave that alone.
Wow.
Yeah, but of course, well, I heard it from the people who actually were the pilots involved. So I guess I believe it. But it's a good, sometimes you just do what you have to do.
You don't know.
You never know.
But, there was another story about the Catholic priest that, there were a number of Catholic priests that worked the area up north.
Mm-hmm.
And this one had thrown his shaving kit and his duffel and stuff under the seat of his plane. And were flying somewhere up north and took some gunfire. And when he got to where he was going, there was a bullet that had gone into his pack and lodged in his shaving kit and hit a razor or something and spent itself before it came on through the seat cushion and got him. But, it just, at the time we were doing all this flying, you didn't think about the dangers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were out there doing our job. I mean, we were young, we were, we didn't know what's going on. We were doing what we were told to do.
Mm-hmm.
You get back and you think about it later, wow, there were some crazy chances we took.
What did you think about the, just overall, the American presence in Laos? And I'm sure people have asked you, do you think it was constructive, or is it something that you just boils down to just what you were doing and really that's what you were there for, or what, when you look back at the experience?
I think they were trying to do the best they could. I mean, I think a lot of their, I think they probably wanted to do more, but I think they were restricted by policy, by, back home, the advisors or whatever back home said you can't, you can go to a certain point, you can't go beyond. I mean, it was just,
well, did you
I think they really believed they in what they were doing.
IVS,
I think,
you mean?
No, I don't think, I was saying the military.
Okay.
But IVS, is, I think most IVSers had a view that, hey, we're going to go over there and do what we can. We're going to save the world and all this stuff. I don't know. You know more about that, talking to different people in different interviews.
Well, no, that's why I'm asking the questions, because, for example, there was a time, I think maybe a little before you were there, and maybe carrying on towards that IVSers found themselves employed in forward areas in the north, and some were menaced, others were killed, and there was a kind of mini revolt inside the IVS, voluntary group.
Okay.
Do you remember any of that?
Most of that, I think, like you say, happened before we got there.
Mm-hmm.
There were several ambushes down, I think, in southern Laos. I can't think of any. There were several that, there were several IVSers that were killed over there, mid-60s. There was one that, a couple that were killed while we were there, early on when we were there. On the road to Pak Son, or on the road to somewhere down toward Vong Bien, or they were doing such a good job, they, bad guys figured, hey, these guys are a threat, take them out. I mean, I think some of those were not random acts. I think they planned to get him.
So in other words, in Laos, in Vietnam, there seemed to be an ability, at least on the part of the Viet Cong, to understand that IVS workers were not the same as, they're not an expression of U.S. policy.
Okay.
In Laos, of course, that would have been harder, the decision harder to make, but also it seemed officially, the Pathet Lao made a radio broadcast where they said they called IVS, they named IVS volunteers as being enemies of the Laotian people.
That would be scary.
Yes.
If I'd hear my name on a Pathet Lao radio, I would be having second thoughts. Maybe it was, and I never heard it, I don't know. But for the most part, I think the people, the locals that worked with the IVSers out in the field had a pretty good feel for what was going on. Obviously, the ones that got killed didn't get the word, but I mean, I think on a couple of those, they took the interpreters and the assistants and everybody. I think they took them all out.
Well, it's a lot of, we're going to have to interview a lot more people
who
had more direct knowledge, because in some cases, for example, a USAID official said that we knew that area had become insecure, we told those people to leave, and they didn't leave. So it was really that they were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And it was the Pathet Lao's way of saying, this is our territory, but they didn't leave. IVSers would contest that and say, no, actually USAID may have known that, but they didn't warn these people in time. And in other words, they were risking these assets. They were an asset like any other.
Right.
And whether we even have the opportunity to, or even
That would be a different chapter because that was pretty much away from our area.
Yes. Well, you and Brenda had a unique experience.
Very
because
much
you were alone. There weren't any other IVS people. Mm-hmm. There was Pop Buell. And
now, there was Diana Dick, who was a nurse that had been there. Right. She was there the first, I think, 6 months or so that Brenda was there. Mm-hmm. That had been, I think she was, I don't know if she was IVS at one time or not. But she was USAID when she was when we got there. But yeah, we did, because we were pretty much isolated up there. Mm-hmm. There was a road that went from Vientiane up there, but it took weeks to get up there. And it was very insecure at places. And so all of our travel back and forth was by air.
Oh, yeah.
And if the weather was bad, you would stay put. Mm. And there were days we went for, well, I think probably the longest was maybe 4 or 5 days without whether it really fogged in or socked in.
Well, because you got to go back to Vientiane a lot, because you didn't see a lot of people up there, but did you ever meet people like, well, actually, there are several varieties of people in Laos. First of all, there are people like Galen Beery. Did you know Galen?
Oh, yeah, I know Galen well.
And who I've seen.
He's yeah,
doing great. And Galen, Howard Lewin, who was a construction USAID, you wouldn't have known
him. I don't know him.
And George Daly, did you ever meet George? He was CIA, actually.
No,
he's not.
No.
You wouldn't have, I don't think so. I'm just asking because.
See, we met a lot of CIA folks, but they would throw out double names, like Dave Dennis or Mr. Clean or all these names. You had no idea who they were. I mean, if I would see a guy, or if I'd see a name, I wouldn't know the name. If I'd see his face, I might know who he was. But a lot of.
Son, I think, passed through Laos. But yeah, I don't think you. I think that was a different time period.
And John Steinbeck was in Laos shortly before we got there. It's in the front of that book. But he was there like in, I think it was in 67, early on. And he visited Sam Tong.
But before you were there.
But within 6 months before we got there.
And
there were news reporters that were up there. There was a NBC News crew that was up there. Wells Hagen? Does that make it?
Hagen?
Wells Hagen? Hagen? They were up there doing an interview, and they left, and something happened, and I don't know if they ever did find out what happened to them. I think it was a plane crash or something, but they disappeared. I think it was Wells Hagen. This was back 67, I think. There were a number of... well, there was a National Geographic crew that came up. Bill Garrett out of Washington, D.C.
No, that's the one that took the picture of Brenda where it said, some woman.
Probably.
Yes, right.
But I talked to him, and interesting guy. He found out I was collecting insects up there, and he said, if you ever want to get rid of your collection, let us know. And interesting guy. But he, you know, just a sidelight about Geographics. I don't know if Brenda told you, I have a collection of Geographics that go all the way back to 1888. And the way they go to get their photographs, I mean, you see an article with 20 or 30 pictures in. They may have taken 2,000 to get those. And they wanted to film this rice drop out of, what was it, a C-46 or, I think it was a C-46, the ones they used to, or maybe it was a, I don't know, rice dropping plane. He wanted to film this rice drop. And the camera he had was, of course, an automatic. And you could crank off 36 shots in, I think, 9 seconds, or four per second or something. Went up, I don't know how many rolls of film he used. They dropped rice all over North Laos to get this shot. And the one that came out in the Geographic, here's a plane, and these rice pallets are bing, 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 perfect stair step. I mean, it was incredible. But he took a lot of rolls to get that one shot. And it was that way with all of their pictures. He said that they... they throw out 90% of the pictures to get the ones
Well,
they
now
use.
The sad thing is that they've begun to, because it's all put on a computer, now they can make the rice pallet, the drops all in that row.
I don't want to hear that.
I know. There was this very famous cover about 3 years ago where they got the Giza pyramids to line up for this shot, and they just moved one over. So they got this really nice, you know, it fits the proportion of the cover, and there was a huge flap about that. And now everyone's discovered that they show those beautiful beaches and ads for... travel things, and they're all cosmetically changed.
Oh, I don't want to hear that. But
so, Brenda's saying, come in there and have. She wants to bring dessert out. No, another 5 minutes for dessert.
5 minutes.
Yes, but I'd like to go back to that and talk about that a little more, just to clarify some things that other people have said. But when you left Samtong for the last time, was that coincidentally when your 2-year period was up?
Yeah, we had arrived in Laos. I think it was right toward the end of August, and because I think our time was from like September to September, and so we had gotten into Laos. It was around the end of August of 67, and so we left right around the end of August of 69. At the end of August, through the first day or so.
How did you feel when you were leaving?
There was some nostalgia. I met some very interesting folks over there. I would love to go back sometime. I think back deep down about, well, if they're still finding little bomblets and they're still blowing up people, but it wouldn't be the same, because the people that I was associated with are all in America now, or they're dead. I mean, the life expectancy of those folks, what, 30, 40, 50 years, you know. There'd be some, of course, but for the most part, the people we met, really nice people. Especially once you got out into the villages. I mean, they were just doing their daily thing. They were trying to make enough food that they could eat. You know, eat, be happy, have kids, try to get the kids to grow up past a certain age. I mean, it was just, you know, I'm sure if I would, I haven't gone through my Laos slides for a number of years, but I took a lot of slides. And if I would go through it now, I'd see a lot of, there'd be a lot of flashbacks, a lot of memories. Myself, I feel we did some good. I did some good, you know. Not necessarily that they're following those, but like I told you earlier, they know there are other ways to do things. Or just the fact that, you know, I met the people, they met me. when we traveled home, we came through India, and this pen pal of Brenda's, the first thing he did was offer me cigarettes, because all Americans smoke. No, I'm sorry, I don't smoke. But all Americans smoke. It's on, you know, that's the way it's, we've heard, you know, that's what's in books. All Americans smoke. No. We had, a lot of times you'd go out in a village, you'd be kind of an oddity. I mean, there'd be all these people, and I've got slides of all these little kids gathered around, and especially when I'm out with a butterfly net chasing butterflies and chasing beetles. I mean, that is an attraction. I mean, there are 50 kids out there. So being a smart American, I'd say, this is what I'm packing. Go out and get some. Man, these little kids would scatter, and they'd come back with handfuls of bugs. It was great. Until they got into the beetles that had that, were a blister-type beetle that had this cantharin in the, on the beetle. And supposedly would cause little blisters. And they'd bring these back, and I'd say thank you and put them in my bottle. And I'd see the kids kind of rubbing their hands and going like that, like, you know, what's going on? My hands are stinging. But for the most part, it was a good 2 years. It was a great chance to see that part of the world, to work with the people, hopefully let a little bit of our culture rub off on them, certainly gain a lot of their culture. Pretty primitive over there. A chance to see the world. I mean, that was one of the reasons when we first went over there, was to see the world. They told us early on that, you know, we'll give you essentially a round-trip ticket, and you can either go straight over and straight back, or you can figure out your schedule to go around the world and come home. We did. And we'd probably not have that opportunity to do that.
Well, you went to India and Africa. And when you came home, what did you decide to do?
When I came home, we got home like in, it was in December of 69. We stayed at my parents' place up in Wenatchee. For some reason, I had heard about Oregon State and Corvallis. And I knew they had an entomology department. And I got in touch with the head of the department, told him a little bit about myself. He said, send in a resume. I did. He called back early January of 1970, and he said, I have a job if you want it. I said, when does it start? He says, whenever you want it to. I started the 12th of January, 1970. And I worked there for 13 and a half years.
13 and a half years.
The position funding ran out. It was like a research assistant on semi-soft money. And out. And so from June until December of '83, I was kind of odd jobbing it. Mm-hmm. Even tried to sell Fuller Brush products for a while. That didn't last very long. Mm-hmm. Sold it to all the neighbors the first time. They didn't want to see me come back. Mm-hmm. In November, December of '69, I contacted a friend of mine who had me in a position to come down there. So I went down there for 6 months, mm-hmm. still living here. I would fly down, work for 3 weeks or a month, take a long weekend, fly home, be home for 3 or 4 days, fly back down, work another 3 weeks or so. I loved the job. Mm-hmm. The job was incredible. I mean, there were 10 million beetles from all over the world. I sorted beetles till I could not sort beetles anymore. I mean, I loved to go to work. I was in heaven. Mm-hmm. I mean, think of the best thing you could ever do. I was there. It was just incredible. But I couldn't keep going back and forth. I mean, I wasn't making any money. I was spending it all on plane tickets back and forth. Mm-hmm. And so after 6 months, I told him that I said, I'm going to have to give this up. And I still see people every now and then say, oh, you're the guy that worked at the Cal Academy that was going back and forth from Oregon. I said, oh, yeah. But then I came back, and in July of 84, yeah, and ours, a friend of mine that I had known at Oregon State was working for the Department of Agriculture in Salem, mm-hmm. and they were starting a gypsy moth program, mm-hmm. to get rid of gypsy moth in Oregon, mm-hmm. starting it down in Eugene. And I called her up, and I said, you need some help? And she says, when can you start? And I said, when do you want me? She said, send me a resume, and you can start whenever you want. And I went to work there in, 10th October of 84. Mm-hmm. And I worked there until 94, until I went to work at Hewlett-Packard.
Yeah, what are you doing at Hewlett-Packard?
Process operator, putting component parts together for print heads. Mm. The little tape that you see on the end of the printer cartridge.
Right.
We make those component parts. And it's totally away from entomology, but it's... Great job, great company. Uh-huh. And we worked the night shift from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., 3 days 1 week, 4 days the next week. Every other weekend is about a 4.5 day weekend, mm-hmm. from Friday morning until Tuesday night. That's not half bad.
That's a pretty good job.
Yeah. And just really enjoying it. And that got us on at Hewlett-Packard. See, Andrea used to work at the Ag Department with me. Uh-huh. In fact, she was, we had a program during the summer where we were insect trappers. Mm-hmm. We would hire a crew to go out and put out gypsy moth traps and Japanese beetle traps. Mm-hmm. And Andrea worked for me for 2 summers. Mm-hmm. And then there was another lady that worked there that had previously worked at Hewlett-Packard for 8 years. She was working as a technician in Salem. And then she went back to work at Hewlett-Packard and started telling us, you know, you guys got to get on at Hewlett-Packard because it's a great place, it's close. Mm-hmm. So she said, send your resume to Palo Alto, give me a copy. She said, I can get you guys on. No problem. And we went to work there. I went to work in September of 94, and Andrea came in early October. We got the same shift, the same different boss.
Upgraded from Brenda a couple of years ago, is it? Or
she went to Hawaii in May of 92. Mm-hmm. Decided that she, originally it was like for the summer, to fill in while other nurses were off on vacation or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then she decided she liked it, and there was no way I was going to go to Hawaii. Nice place to visit, but I wouldn't live there. And things had not been real rosy for, you know, several years before that.
Oh, that's okay. We don't want to know all.
No, we don't want to get into that.
I just
anyway,
want to understand that you're, you know, as we go through the tape, that you're with another partner now. That's all. And
so, yeah, she left in '92, and we were divorced in '95, and. That's history, and this is now, and
that's right.
Things look great.
Things look great. A question, getting back to a couple of questions I wanted to ask, because they've come up in the other interviews. Mm-hmm. When I was talking to Brenda, I said, well, you know, there's all this military around there, and Gary's a brethren. He's a CO status. Well, how did he handle that? She said, well, we kept a very low profile. We couldn't advertise that.
That is exactly right. Yeah. Like I told you, I was not forced into going to IBS. Mm-hmm. The bit about my military service or lack of military service never came up. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to do something for a couple of years. I wanted to see the world. I didn't broadcast it when I was over there that I'm a CO. Once I got over there, I think I changed my views on CO a lot.
Mm-hmm. Really? In what way?
Well, you know, the brethren is a pacifist, peace-loving church and all this stuff. But after I spent a little time in Laos and saw all the stuff that was going on, I wanted to go out and get those bad guys. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it was just, it was like, I mean, I had had this preached into me, but I'd never seen the other side. Mm-hmm. And war is no fun, and you either better play it to win or you better not be in the business. Of, you know, and it's just, there were so many gray areas that were being done that, I don't know, it just, my views did change a lot mm-hmm. being over there. Mm-hmm. And if I would have to go back, if somebody would ask me right now, you know, are you a CO? I probably would say, no, I'm not. Mm-hmm. I'm not a, you know, military nut or anything.
Yeah.
But things, you know, your views change. Yeah.
Did you have any feelings, though, when you were handed a pistol that were other than your own survival? Just, is this my role here? Do I, I'm a lover, not a fighter?
At that point, I thought, well, if this was, is what it's going to take to keep me alive, I'll shoot it. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I'll shoot at, but I'll pull the trigger.
So you were essentially so deep into it that it didn't occur to you to say, if this is what it takes for me to operate here, I'm going to leave.
The last 6 months were pretty shaky up there. Mm-hmm. And like I say, the women were sent out. We were up there. We stayed pretty close to what was going on. I mean, there were reports coming in all the time. And if the bad guys would get really close, they would have evacuated us, I'm mm-hmm. sure. But it was... The last 6 months was not a real good time to be up there. Mm-hmm. I mean, things were tense. The villages further, you know, not too far from Sam Tong that were falling. Then they get taken back, then they'd fall again, then they'd move a little bit closer. And like I say, at one point the enemy was only 2 kilometers away, but there were two pretty bad ridges in between. So, and since they didn't have planes, they couldn't come flying over and do anything. But it was a nervous time the last 6 months.
Yeah, speaking of airplanes, Brenda remembers once that some North Vietnamese biplane was captured or something. What was that about?
I don't know if this is out. This is probably out somewhere. It's probably okay. There was some North Vietnamese, an old biplane, that they had it set up in the middle part of the fuselage with essentially a framework that they had these little bombs that were sitting in there that they could pull a little lever and drop a little bomb. Mm-hmm. And it was flown by Chinese. And their plan was they were going to fly over one of these outposts up in, not, I don't think, too far from the Chinese border, because we were pretty close to Chinese border. I mean, we were not that far. North Vietnam over here and China right here. And they were going to fly over and drop these little bombs on this village. Mm-hmm. And I think there were two pilots in it, or two people flying it. They got, I guess, partway over, and I heard some of the report on the radio that there were two helicopters that intercepted this plane. Mm-hmm. And these guys in the helicopter were shooting at this plane with AK-47s mm-hmm. or their M-16s or whatever. There were probably some AK-47s involved, too. But they were essentially shooting at this plane. They shot it down mm-hmm. with flying around with helicopters. I mean, mm-hmm. This was an old biplane.
Right.
And it wasn't very fast. In fact, I saw the bodies at Long Chang. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I'd seen a body close up that had bullet holes in it. Mm-hmm. Two Chinese. And in fact, that's the one roll of film that was confiscated. Because, see, like a dummy, I would take my film to Long Chang.
Mm-hmm. To develop.
Put it in the mailbox. In the mail slot to go down to Bangkok to redevelop. Well, I was over there with my little camera, and I was taking pictures, and I'm sure some... That was one of the quirks of one of the little strange things. Another one, the Lao Air Force, which is kind of a joke, but they had these P-38s and these World War II fighter planes that, mm-hmm. that were they were using over there for strafing runs and little bombing missions and all this. Well,
there they had P-38s.
I think they were
P-38s. Twin engine, with boom tail?
No, not P-38s.
P-51s. Right.
Yeah, Mustangs.
Right,
or,
Mustangs. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's what they were. They were
I'm pretty sure
big engine. And big engine. Noisier than hell. And
but air-cooled, not a radio. The nose came to a point, or was it open?
Some of them were open.
Okay.
I may have pictures of those
They might be converted trainers.
They could have been.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
They were used a lot. They had, the Laotian Air Force had a lot of T-38s, I think they were
called. Probably what they were.
Yeah. Big engine.
Yeah.
Really big. Yeah. Unbelievably big.
Noisy. Big.
Yes, yes.
Well, there was an American that was doing some training, I think out of Longchang. Or no, out of Vientiane. Because he was up country and something, he got an oil leak in his plane. Mm-hmm. We were all over at Longchang having this big party one night. Mm-hmm. It's called a bossy, where they get lots of whiskey and lots of lao hai and lots of food, and everybody just gets snockered. Well, we were having this party, and the word came, this guy's going to come in, that his plane is running out of oil, and he's gonna come in. So they had a makeshift set of lights at the airport. So they put these lights on, and this plane comes in and landed without any trouble. American pilot, so they bring him over to this party. And here is this guy. He just landed in the middle of nowhere in North Laos. He had no idea what was going on. They bring him over, and here are all these Americans and all these natives having this wild party. And this guy said, I think I died and went to heaven. It was so incredible. But strange things over there.
I think it's strange about the biplane is that, I mean, Laos was the second most bombed country in the world after South Vietnam.
Yeah.
And Frisian about this biplane, you know, it's just so there's a wonderful incongruity
It was weird. I don't know what their plans were, what their ideas, who put them up to. Well, the North Vietnamese probably put them up.
There must have been a purpose for it, but it's interesting.
But their plan was they were going to come over and bomb something that they didn't like,
mm-hmm.
and they had no chance in hell, and they probably knew it. But but it was,
and Chinese pilots to boot.
I'm pretty sure they were Chinese pilots.
Well, that was Brenda's impression, too.
Yeah.
But why did the plane land in Samtong instead of just going into Longchang? I mean, why did they bring the bodies there?
That was the nearest military outpost. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just, anything that went on up there, they picked up the whole fuselage and they brought it in, and it was sitting there at Longchang. Then I think they either broke it up into pieces and took it down to...
Mm-hmm.
Or they brought Longchang and then probably took it down to Vientiane. Wings were off by the time I got down there.
But, well, is there a great story that I haven't asked you, or a question that you expected me to ask and I didn't, or
no? I'm totally wide open. I had no idea what to expect. Yeah. I figured I'd just wing it.
Well, surely there must be some story from Laos that you have that on, you know, cold winter nights when you sit back and say, I remember that time. When Errol Flynn's son...
Heard of the White Rose in Vientiane?
Uh-huh, yes, yeah. That was a very famous strip club or something like that.
They would do things with animals and snakes that you couldn't imagine.
Uh-huh.
And there's a story in the movie Air America where they take that senator there.
Right, right.
That actually happened. Mm-hmm. That was from fact.
Mm-hmm.
We knew the military attaché that took him there.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the name of the senator. I mean, like...
We know who it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he was quite appalled that something was going on like that. But that was a famous spot. Some incredible time sitting there along the Mekong having fabulous French cooking, French onion soup.
Mm-hmm.
Vientiane, like a lot of these Asian countries or Asian capitals, have all these different kinds of foods. You know, everywhere. I mean, every shopkeeper, it seems like, in Laos is an Indian. Mm-hmm. Indian shopkeepers, they're real businessmen. And incredible restaurants. Got some chances to go down to, we went to Hong Kong for one vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Went down to, took the train, or we flew down to Bangkok, took the train down to Pattaya. Pattaya Beach, that was before it was really developed.
Mm-hmm.
It was very laid back, quiet. Took the train clear down through Malaysia to Singapore. Spent time in Kuala Lumpur and went to Singapore. Did Brenda tell you anything about the China Fleet Club in Hong Kong?
No.
That was a great experience. China Fleet Club is, you know, military PX type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is way discounted. And some of our friends in IVS early on said, if you ever get to Hong Kong, go to the China Fleet Club.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, what they do, you can go in there because it's military, but They won't ask you any questions, but what they do, each time you make a purchase, they have this form that you have to fill out. Mm-hmm. They want your name, rank, and serial number. Mm-hmm. So they said, what you do, what worked for us, they said, you just put down your name and put Laos and don't put anything else. And if they ask you, tell them that you're working in Laos and that's all you're allowed to put down.
Uh-huh.
Okay, fine. So we go to the China Fleet Club. And the first thing we found was one of these little mink hats for Brenda. Mm-hmm. And genuine mink and all this stuff. And so we got that. It was a separate department, so we had to go pay for it. So sure enough, out comes the paper. I put down my name, put down Laos, hand it back to her, and she said, we need to have your rank. Oh, I understand, no problem. We bought that hat, we bought pearls, we bought an entire stereo outfit, which I still have, an Akai reel-to-reel, the speakers, the tape deck, the whole thing. I don't think we bought any clothes there, mostly the stereo stuff. Mm-hmm. And on four or five different occasions, they brought out the paper, and that's all we put down. And they said, oh, we understand. Because everything was so mixed up over there. They, like I said earlier, about, the plane ride, there's CIA, and mm-hmm. there's Air America, and there's everybody is working there, and nobody knows who anybody else is, and they're not going to ask any questions. A few months later, they stopped it. They found out that IBS is nobody. And so that went down. If you get anybody comes in there and puts down their name and their Laos, say, forget it, kick them out. And so that stopped, but that was after the fact. But that was fun. On that same trip to Hong Kong, we were going to go to Macau. Mm-hmm. Well, at the time, American military of any type could not go to Macau. Mm-hmm. It was off limits for some reason. So we're sitting around this big table. If you go to a tailor over there and get some clothes made or get shoes made or something, this one tailor would get all these people together and take them out to a full-blown Chinese dinner. Mm-hmm. I mean, a 10-course Chinese dinner. I mean, and we sat around this table with probably 15 or 18 people around there, and they brought food till we were so full we could hardly move. Mm-hmm. And most of them were military folks. Mm-hmm. And so here we're sitting here eating with them, and everybody's trying to figure out who we are, and we're trying to figure out who they are, and nobody's in uniform, everybody's, casual. And I think most of the people had us figured out as CIA or something, but what's that woman doing there with him? But when we said we were going to Macau the next day, that blew them out of the water, because they could not understand, okay, we've got them pegged as military, but how in the hell did they get clearance to go to Macau? And we loved it. It was crazy. But, yeah, there's a lot of crazy stories. We had some great parties. There's one military attaché that we still correspond with. Mm-hmm. I think he's in Bosnia.
He's
now.
In Bosnia. Yeah.
Somebody asked him one time how he spends his time in North Laos, or how do you survive up there? He says, stay drunk. He made killer margaritas. He was from somewhere in Texas. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people, especially the pilots in the military, I think they take it one day at a time. Mm-hmm.
When you saw Air America, I mean, you mentioned that there were mm-hmm. a couple of things like that. Did it spark any other memories?
I'm sure the whole thing was probably made in the Philippines.
Oh, yes, definitely.
But some of the airstrips, some of the planes, I mean, I'd see those planes, I'd think back of the numbers on the planes, mm-hmm. like I say, a real AR, and I can still remember numbers on planes that I flew on. There was an old helicopter, P-51, or R-51 or something. But it was fun. I want to get that movie sometime just to have it, because there were some things that were pretty close.
Well, a lot of people, of course, usually when anything's made in a film, everyone says, oh, it's all overblown, because it has to be for the big screen.
There was a lot of things, but there were some things that, I mean, they interviewed a lot of Air America people and to make the film, and there were some things that were true.
Yeah, I knew some pilots like that.
Yeah.
And there's one character in there that, it's one of those things, I swear I know that guy.
Yeah,
there were guys,
I would see the movie and I'd think back, yeah, that's so-and-so.
Mm-hmm. It's always a composite, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's
incredible pilots over there. I mean, some of those guys, there was one pilot that went to sleep on us a couple times. I mean, this guy was strange. You'd start flying, he'd set the compass, and you'd look over and he'd be sitting there like that. Are we going the right way? Oh, yeah, we're fine, where are we? And you'd look at, another pilot that was, he'd been flying up there a long time, and he was one of the few that would take off in bad weather. Mm-hmm. He would take off from Sam Tong, he would spiral up through the clouds to a certain altitude, he would set his compass, he would fly for an hour and 20 minutes, he would spiral down through, and there'd be the airport. Like he'd fly to Longchang or to Luang Prabang. Mm-hmm. which had a good sized airport, and I mean he knew exactly where he was. I mean, it was crazy. Yeah, you could get together with Air America, you could get all kinds of war stories. But yeah, it was a good time. And I think they're ready.
Well, they're ready now. I think they've been drinking. Yes, but anyway, thank you very much, Gary. If I think of anything more, I'll be in touch. But thank you very much.
Enjoyed it.
Enjoyed it.